Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Police in Hong Kong used tear gas and water cannon against demonstrators during protests on the 70th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. In one incident, a police officer shot an 18-year-old protester in the chest, leaving him bleeding. A police spokesperson said the officer feared for his life. She said the person was taken to a hospital for treatment. She provided no other information. Officers have fired warning shots in the air before, but this is the first report that a protester has been shot. A video of the incident appeared on CNN news broadcasts. Hong Kong's hospital authority said 51 people were injured in all, two in critical condition. A police statement said, "There are rioting acts across Kowloon, Hong Kong, and the new territories." Police used tear gas in at least six places in the city. They also used water cannon in the business district where protesters appeared in large numbers. The protesters, many wearing gas masks and holding sticks, burned signs and tires that poured smoke into the air. Organizers said at least 100,000 people marched, although the government had banned demonstrations during the holiday. The protests have continued for almost 4 months. The uprising is the biggest political crisis Hong Kong has faced since 1997, when it returned to Chinese control. One marcher, a 42-year-old woman who identified herself as Lee, said, "I'm not young, but if we don't march now, we'll never have the chance to speak again. It's as simple as that." Protesters threw fuel bombs, known as Molotov cocktails, outside the central government offices in the Admiralty area of Hong Kong Island on Tuesday. Officials asked people to leave the Legislative Council building nearby for safety reasons. Clashes also took place in the New Territories area that borders mainland China. Police said rioters there used a harmful fluid that injured multiple police officers and reporters. Rioters threw Molotov cocktails at Chinese banks and Chinese-supported businesses and painted anti-China messages on buildings. Local broadcaster RTHK said it was withdrawing its reporters from areas of violence after one was hit on the head. The protesters had promised to use China's National Day to propel their calls for greater democracy. October 1st marks the 70th year since the establishment of the People's Republic of China. Hundreds of officials observed National Day celebrations at the city's Convention and Exhibition Center, where security was tight. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
Many studies have tied red meat to cancer and heart disease. But are the risks big enough to stop eating foods like lamb chops and hamburgers? A team of international researchers says probably not. Their findings, published as a series of papers Monday, go against established advice. A group of well-known U.S. scientists even took the unusual step of trying to stop publication until their criticisms were answered. The new work does not say that red meat and processed meats, such as hot dogs and bacon, are healthy. It also does not suggest that people should eat more of these foods. The new work examined past studies on red meat and health problems. The researchers involved generally support the finding that red meat is tied to cancer, heart disease, and other serious health risks. But the researchers also say the evidence is weak. They say there could be other causes for the apparent link, including a person's other food choices and lifestyle. Dr. Gordon Guyot is with Canada's McMaster University. He was a co-writer of the new work. He said most people who understand the degree of risks involved would say, "Thanks very much, but I'm going to keep eating my meat." The new work is the latest example of the divisiveness in food research. Critics say scientific findings on the subject often have weak evidence. Defenders argue that nutrition studies can rarely be conclusive because of the difficulty of measuring the effects of any single food. Methods have improved, however. What we need to do is look at the weight of evidence. That's what courts of law use, said Dr. Walter Willett, a professor of nutrition at Harvard University. He was among those calling for the paper's publication to be delayed. Willett has led studies tying meat to bad health problems. He said the recent series of papers do not consider the especially clear benefits of changing from red meat to vegetarian choices. In the papers, the writers sought to understand the possible effects of eating less meat. They noted the average of 2 to 4 servings a week eaten in North America and Western Europe. They said the evidence for cutting back was not strong. For example, they found that cutting 3 servings of red meat a week would result in 7 fewer cancer deaths per 1,000 people. Based on the review, a panel of the international researchers involved in the work said people do not have to cut back for health reasons. But they note their own advice is weak. They also note they were not considering other possible reasons for eating less red meat, such as concern for animals and the harmful effects to the environment. There was disagreement even among the writers. 3 of the 14 panelists said they support reducing red and processed meats in the human diet. And a co-writer of one of the papers also called for a publication delay. The journal Annals of Internal Medicine defended the new work. It said the request to have it pulled before publication is not how scientific debate is supposed to happen. Experts from Harvard, Yale, Stanford, and other top American universities sent a letter to the journal asking that it retract publication of the papers. The experts said recommendations that could lead people to eat more red and processed meat were irresponsible and unethical. The World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer and the World Cancer Research Fund both say red and processed meat may or can cause cancer.
A U.S. federal judge ruled Tuesday that Harvard University's admission policy does not discriminate against Asian American students. Judge Allison Burroughs said that although Harvard's admission program is not perfect, it passes constitutional muster. The judge wrote in her decision that creating diversity at Harvard relies, in part, on race-conscious admissions. She added, "There is no evidence that any admission decision was negatively affected by Asian American identity." The group Students for Fair Admissions, SFFA, brought legal action against the Ivy League school in 2014. SFFA says it will appeal the decision to a higher court. Edward Blum, the group's president, said in a statement that the evidence SFFA presented during the three-week trial revealed Harvard's systemic discrimination against Asian American applicants. Harvard did not immediately answer requests for comment. The SFFA argued that Harvard held Asian Americans to a higher standard in admissions. The group said the Ivy League school gave preference to Black and Hispanic students with lower grades. The SFFA centered its argument on a subjective, personal rating that Harvard gives to applicants. The group claimed Asian Americans often receive lower personal ratings than Black and Hispanic applicants. This SFFA said, led to the rejection of Asian American applicants who had stronger academic records. In a 2013 internal report, Harvard found that if the school weighed applicants based only on academic records, 43% of the admitted class would be Asian American. The actual percentage of Asian Americans was 19%. Harvard denies using discriminatory practices in its admissions process. The school says it uses race as one of many things it considers in admissions decisions. It believes considering race can help create a mixed community where students from all walks of life can learn with and from each other. Harvard called SFFA a political group with no real interest in helping Asian Americans. During the trial, no students testified that they had faced discrimination by Harvard. The U.S. Supreme Court has heard several cases about affirmative action in recent years. The court's most recent decision on the subject approved limited use of race in the admission process. That 2016 decision came from a lawsuit against the University of Texas that accused the school of discriminating against white students. I'm Ann Ball.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In 1801, America had a new president, Thomas Jefferson from the state of Virginia. Jefferson had already done much for his country. He wrote the Declaration of Independence in 1776. He served as America's first ambassador to France and the first Secretary of State. Now he would govern the nation. Thomas Jefferson was happy and hopeful as he took office. His new political party, the Republicans, had defeated the older Federalist Party. The Federalists had controlled the cabinet and the Congress during President George Washington's two terms. George Washington was not a Federalist, but America's second president, John Adams, was. Altogether, the Federalists had been in power for 12 years. The Federalists and the Republicans held very different opinions about how to govern the nation. The Federalists feared that Jefferson and his followers would destroy the social order of the new country. And Jefferson's Republican Party feared that the Federalists would put power in the hands of a few elite people.
The fears of neither side were really justified, but it was a remarkable moment because the election of 1800 was extremely partisan, but it was also the first occasion in which power was exchanged from one party to another without any kind of violence or a revolution.
Andrew O'Shaughnessy directs an international center for Jefferson studies at Thomas Jefferson's home called Monticello. He says emotions between the Federalists and the Republicans were still strong when Jefferson took office. But in his inaugural address, the new president extended the hand of peace and friendship to the Federalists. In his words, "We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." The leader of the Federalist Party, Alexander Hamilton, did not accept Jefferson's offer of friendship. As Jefferson became president, Hamilton made a speech attacking him. Hamilton had decided to continue fighting the Democratic movement in the United States. But Hamilton's opposition did not worry Jefferson. Of course, he said, the top leaders of the Federalists, men like Hamilton, could never be changed. He was more interested in bringing their followers to his side. He was sure he could show even the Federalists that his program was good for all. In fact, Andrew O'Shaughnessy says, Jefferson expected the Federalist Party just to disappear. He says, people in Jefferson's time did not think a two-party system was essential to democracy.
They thought if people acted in a public spirit and put aside their own self-interest, that they would all recognize the common good and act together.
And he says Jefferson believed his party, the Republicans, represented the true spirit of the American Revolution. In those early days of 1801, Jefferson said, "We can no longer say that there is nothing new under the sun. What we have done in this country is all new. The force of public opinion is new. But the most important and pleasing newness is that we have changed our government without violence. This shows a strength of American character that will give long life to our republic. We have proved that freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and freedom of thought are necessary in a healthy nation. Let men argue with each other. The arguments may become bitter, but the bitterness is just a cloud that passes. And out of the arguments will come the truth." As for the Federalist leaders, they, except for Hamilton, believed Jefferson's friendly words in his inaugural speech showed he would respect their party. George Cabot, the strongest Federalist leader in New England, usually agreed with Hamilton, but now he did not. Cabot said, "I believe that our new president wants to stay out of war. We do not have to worry any longer that he plans to join France against England. He is friendly to us and wants our help. Therefore, I am sure that he will not dismiss any of our people from their government positions." Another Federalist leader, Timothy Pickering, the Secretary of State under President Adams, said, "I am satisfied that Jefferson will not make any important changes in government policy and that he will depend for support more on us Federalists than on the Democrats." During those first few weeks of the new government, the Federalist leaders really believed that Jefferson was afraid of them. They believed that he had surrendered to them and would be destroyed as the leader of the Republican Party. One Federalist wrote, "Soon Jefferson will feel the bite of his dirty Democrats when they attack him." Jefferson soon did hear complaints from Republican leaders who felt he was being too kind to the Federalists. William Giles, a Jeffersonian leader in Virginia, wrote, "Of course I am very pleased by the president's inaugural speech. The president's program is correct. It agrees with the opinions of the people. But I still think that the president's success will depend on how he carries out his program. Let him offer friendship to the Federalists, but he must not permit friendship to become weakness. His friends believe that the first thing he must do is to clean out the executive branch of the government. He must dismiss from office all men who are enemies of the Republican program." Even James Monroe wrote a strong letter to the president, "Your speech and your program are healthy and good, but there are serious dangers ahead of you. There are two parties in this country, not one. One of these parties, the Federalists, has controlled the government for 12 years and has hurt our nation greatly. Some of these Federalists now speak softly to you and promise their support. But you must remember, too, that there are thousands of good Republicans who have always supported you. If you keep Federalists in office, if you appoint Federalists to office, many of these good Republicans will stop believing in you. Certainly, there is no reason why you should give jobs to men who worked for the Federalist government of John Adams. Certainly, you must throw out the officials of the last government who stole money and sold their services. Do this, and you will give strength to our Republican movement. Please understand me. I am speaking only of high offices. I do not ask that you dismiss small officials because they are Federalists. They have a right to their political beliefs. Let them keep their jobs. This will show that you are a president who can accept different political opinions. As Federalists and Republican leaders kept asking Jefferson for positions in the government, the president was thinking of his cabinet. He quickly decided who would be his Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury. James Madison of Virginia, Jefferson's old friend and the father of the Constitution, would be Secretary of State. For Secretary of the Treasury, Jefferson chose Albert Gallatin of Pennsylvania, the brilliant leader of the Republicans in Congress. Gallatin understood economics and finance as well as Alexander Hamilton did. For the War Department, Jefferson turned to General Henry Dearborn of New England. Jefferson's first choice to be Secretary of the Navy was Judge Robert Livingston, the great lawyer from New York. But Judge Livingston rejected this position. Jefferson finally chose Robert Smith of Baltimore, Maryland. The president had already appointed one man from New England to his cabinet, Secretary of War Dearborn. Now he turned to New England for two more appointments. Jefferson knew that the strength of the Federalist Party was greater in New England than in any other part of the country. He believed that there was no better way to move New England away from the Federalist program than to give cabinet positions to men from New England. And so, Jefferson found his attorney general in Levi Lincoln of Massachusetts. Like Dearborn, Lincoln was a patriot of the American Revolution. He had been a supporter of Jefferson from the beginning. He was famous as a lawyer in Massachusetts, where he was the top leader of the Republican Party. Jefferson turned to New England as well for the Postmaster General. It was not yet a cabinet office, but its importance was growing. The president gave this appointment to Gideon Granger, a lawyer, businessman, and writer. Granger was one of the strong Jeffersonians in the state of Connecticut. Such was Jefferson's cabinet, all strong Republicans, all completely loyal. The Federalists were shocked. Not one member of their party had been appointed.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.